Hey, hey, friends. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason, our second show this week. Well, thank you for joining me, by the way. I am looking at the story of why God died and came to life again. Now, I'm a little uncomfortable talking about this because I wrote this book. And actually, what I wrote was a larger book called The Story of Reality, which you know about. And then I, with the cooperation of Zondervan, excised, six chapters? Yeah, six chapters, The God-Man, The Rescue, Footsteps, The Trade, Trust, and Four Facts. Wrote a couple of pages of introduction and then an epilogue so I can ramp up into that material and ramp down, and that's all I did. So it was a modest amount of effort on my part to produce a volume that is a repetition of something that I'd already written. But as the point is for me that I wanted to isolate these chapters that focus principally on the person and the work of Christ, because this is what people. This is the heart of it, okay? The story of reality starts at the beginning, goes to the end, how the world began, how it ends, and everything important that happens in between. It's meant to show the coherence of the Christian worldview, okay? However, this particular booklet is meant to isolate just that section on the gospel, the work of Christ, since many conversations just focus in on that part. Most of you are not going to start your communication with somebody in Genesis, okay, and then end in Revelation. You're going to kind of cut a little bit more to the chase, but you want to say something that's coherent and makes sense. And so this is why I put this little booklet together. We had it assembled, all right? Having said that, though, and this is where I feel a little uncomfortable, I really love this little book. I really do. It's 85, 86 pages long, and it's small footprint, okay? So you could probably, just about anybody could read this book in an hour. It's almost like a tract in a way. It's a small thing you hand to somebody so they can read it fairly quickly and get the core substantive information but communicate it in a way that's accessible. And that's why I'm telling you about it, because I hope you get some of these. And you give them away. Easter's coming up, and this is a great opportunity to invite people to church. And in fact, let me just finish the thought. It's a great opportunity to invite people to church, and to and expose them to a joyous celebration of one of the most important events in history. When I say one of the most important, I mean it's right up there, like with the beginning of the universe and the incarnation and the second coming. So we're, you know, that's like, wow, the resurrection of Jesus after he had been crucified for our sins. Well, that's a big deal. So you bring people to church and they get exposed to that, and it's not unusual for that exposure to be the circumstance that actually changes their mind. And so what I've tried to do is put a booklet together that could supplement or augment that enterprise. You have friends that maybe you've been talking in a general way with about Christianity, you want to invite them, or maybe they won't come, but they'll read a book. And so that's what this is for. The story of why God died and came to life again. It's only $3.99. And I think if you... I mean, that's not much, right? That's a Starbucks coffee in the airport. That's not even a big one. That's not a venti. That's just a... Actually, it costs you more if you get one of those frothy things that they stir up there and grind up and foam up and all that. It's a great little purchase. I think that if you get it at Stand to Reason, STR.org, and you get 10 of them, you get a discount or something. I just want to tell you it's available. We're the only ones who have it right now. So it doesn't have a general release. We just had a lot of them printed up, and we have them, and it'll go out more generally later. But if you are part of a church and want to, you know, bundle these up for your newcomers or something, you can give us a contact us. Go to str.org, and I think it's right there on the homepage, and then you can order some for your church. I've just heard some folks have been doing that. So a story of why God died and came to life again. Now, I want to tell you a little story about that story, or at least about that book, because I was on the airplane going to Oakland on Friday and did some teaching there all day long, 9 in the morning till 6 at night, pretty much standing the whole time doing a lot of different talks. I did get a little break, but it was a long day. Glad for it, too. Great people that I got to work with. When I was on the airplane, though, I sat down next to a young man. He's probably mid-30s, I should say. Might be young for me. Mid-30s, Chinese man, very polite, had a book there. Following my game plan, I just asked him about what he was reading. What do you mean by that, right? So what are you reading? Well, it's a book on writing and how to write better. And I asked him, are you a writer? And he said, no, I just want to write better. And because English isn't my first language, it's my second. And so this will help me in my writing and communication skills. And I said, well, I'm a writer. And he said, really? Well, what have you written? And so there in my bag, what did I have? I have a copy of The Story of Reality, and I've got a copy of The Story of Why God Died and Came to Life Again. And I asked the gentleman, have you ever heard anything about Christianity? And he said, no, not really. Can you imagine that? He knew almost nothing about Christianity. He's a businessman. He was a consultant in, like a CPA consultant, right? And so I said, if I gave you a book, would you read it? You don't have to take it if you don't want it. My feelings won't be hurt. And so I offered him The Story of Why God Died. The reason I offered him this book is because I didn't want him to start at Genesis and go to Revelation. English is his second language, not his first. He didn't have any exposure to this. I just wanted him to see Jesus, which is where this starts. Let me just see. What is the first chapter of this? The God-man, okay? And so he said yes, he was happy to take it. So I was glad. Now, as I am handing this to him, remember, we're on the plane. People are getting on still. They're boarding. And somebody's walking by, a young man and his girlfriend, I don't know. They were kind of hip-looking, like hippie type. What I remember, the hippies, like I was one back in the 60s, but we had long hair. He had his head shaved, so that's the new look of the hip movement. And kind of pantaloon pants and a kind of a hat on, and he looks like earthy, right? And he looked over his shoulder, and he saw the Why God Died, and I also had in my hand The Story of Reality, and he said, hey, is that a book about Christianity or something like that? He just kind of showed an interest, and then I said, and the Chinese man said, yeah, he wrote that book, and then they went and got a couple of seats back, but I figured, well, we got somebody's interested, right? So when I got off the plane in Oakland, I waited for this young man to come out, and we just chatted for a few minutes, and I asked him if he was a Christian. He said, well, I don't know if I would use that word to describe myself. He said, I love Jesus. Okay, well, that was good, but then I wasn't sure what was going on with him. He loves Jesus, but he doesn't want to call himself a Christian. Well, there's kind of people have mixed ideas about what that means and what they think about it, so maybe. And he said, I used to be a Buddhist, and now I had this incredible experience with the man upstairs, is the way he put it, and so now I'm not sure where I'm at. Now, I didn't have time to really flesh this all out, but I just want you to notice that there were a couple of things going on here. I'm asking a lot of questions. I'm using my game plan. There is a live opportunity. Somebody's showing interest. It's completely friendly. Every part of these two conversations were completely friendly, but he's an American, right? And even though he came out of Buddhism, and I'd mentioned, well, what Jesus taught was very different than what the Buddha taught, and then he said, well, there are some similarities too. Okay, I'm not going to fight that battle, but would you like a book? Would you like The Story of Reality? Which he had been looking over the shoulder, the Chinese guy, to see in my lap and asked about when he got on the airplane. And he said, yeah, I'll be glad to read it. I love reading. So by the time I got to Oakland, I had both of my books, had given them away. I always carry both of them in my bag for this kind of thing. And I had given them away, and I think in a kind of, divine appointment situation, sometimes you're just ships passing in the night. Sometimes you have this really profound engagement and great things happen. And other times it's not exactly ships passing in the night, but the contact is fairly brief, but it's something that it seems like God put together. And if you're there with a word or a question or a book, then you might put a stone in someone's shoe. And in my case, I had them all, a word, a question, and two books. And I think that the books went to the right people. The smaller one, the story of why God died and came to life again to the Chinese man. And the longer one, which would give a very, very clear characterization of how the Christian understanding of reality is entirely different than the Buddhist understanding of reality. I was able to give it to the person who was formerly Buddhist, now had some kind of encounter with God, and seemed to be moving towards Jesus. And it just seemed like the right thing. So I'm glad I had those books, and I'm glad they have been. They have them now, and I prayed for both of them as I headed out of the airport. But you never know what God's going to do. You never know. All right, let's go to the callers. And first off, we have Jason in Washington, D.C. Hello, Jason.
Hello.
How you doing?
Fantastic. It's Greg Kogel.
Yes, it is. That last time I checked. Nice to have you on board, Jason.
Well, it's an honor. I'm a huge fan. I won't gush too much, but I loved the opening. I loved hearing. I've been listening for years about these encounters that you have, and until I started having them myself, honestly, I just thought that, you know, they were interestingly anecdotal, but it really is cool to go out there and plant seeds.
Yes, it is. And you know what? Part of what I was trying, I hope, was coming across is that there was nothing, in a certain sense, there was no cleverness on my part here. There was no quick response, getting him in a corner with the right apology. I mean, it was just you just kind of going with the flow and being alert and being open and asking a few questions and then seeing what happens. And in this case, a couple of things seem to happen. And I don't know where the Lord's going to take it, but it is, you're right, it's planting a seed, putting a stone in their shoe, however you want to characterize it. Sometimes it's not very difficult. And you never know what kind of incredible thing God might do down the line, which we may never find out until, you know, after the resurrection. But it is in God's hands, and I can just leave it there. So that happened. Apparently it happens to you, too, now that you've been stepping out a little bit on your own.
I have to admit, I don't know, I get energized by it. But in particular, once I got past the whole... And I again, credit this to you and your staff, that once the pressure was off me after I read Tactics a couple of times, and I realized, you know, I don't have to be the guy. I don't have to be the harvester.
The closer, right. No, exactly right. You can be the gardener instead of the harvester.
Plus, just as you described on the plane, I mean, this is important stuff, eternal stuff, but you could have filled in the blank with any other topic. You are a friendly guy. You could have talked sports or politics. I would have sat there on the plane and listened. I'm having fun having these conversations. And thanks again for the story of reality. I ate that one up. And I guess you kind of opened up with, and it kind of leads into my question.
Okay.
And my frustration. So I didn't have a church background growing up, and honestly, except for the fact that I married a born and raised in the church, beautiful woman who can't see not having that as a part of her, you know, lifestyle, I had to, you know, acquiesce, and we had to go to church. But we have left a number of them just beyond the fact that, one, I wasn't getting fed, and two— uh-huh. I just don't. They're so anti-apologetic or anti-evangelistic. I'm just at a loss. It's almost bordering on xenophobic.
Well, you know, I'm curious about this, though. I'm not surprised that you'd be in a church that was anti-apologetics. When you added anti-evangelistic, that really struck me as odd. What kind of churches are you going to? I guess is the question I wanted to ask.
Great question. I guess I'm primarily describing the church I left after 5 years. It's going on 3 years ago now. I like to believe I'm in a great church now.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, the church that I left was just strangely, we don't talk to them. We don't talk to other churches. We don't, and you know, I'm not, you know, well versed in the churches and the
right. I'm not so concerned about, in a certain sense, the social environment of the church. I'm concerned about or interested in what is their understanding of the Bible and of God and of Jesus, and how that all relates to training and encouraging and nurturing Christians that come into their building on Sundays and are part of their community. Do they believe that the Bible speaks accurately and truthfully to our condition, and that people need to believe in Jesus in order to know God and to have eternal life, and that part of their job is feeding you from the Scriptures so that you can grow?
Well, I'm not sounding like I'm embellishing. I would just tell you, you'd have to see for yourself, but those are the kind of questions that just stymied me to the point where it took about 5 years, but I just had to leave. I'll just, in a nutshell, give you, here's the pushback that I received.
Okay.
When I asked, you know, in various forms, is the Great Commission optional because you seem to be doing everything under the sun to avoid it?
Right.
Their response was to quote a often, you know, and you said it yourself, never read a Bible verse, mm-hmm. but often taken out of context, scripture talking about, you know, vain philosophies and don't waste your time with that.
Yeah, that's in Colossians chapter. I know that passage is Colossians chapter 2, but what it says there, it says, don't be taken captive by philosophy and empty deception, according to the traditions of men, according to the elementary principles of the world, rather than according to Christ. So what is what Paul warns against there is not philosophy, but certain types of philosophies. What philosophies? Philosophies of men that are contrary to Christ. So Jesus sees the world one way, the world sees reality a different way, and Jesus got it right and they got it wrong. And so we are not to be taken in by their way. But the only way we can be protected from being taken in by the world's view is for churches to teach Jesus' view and point to the world's view and say, see, here's what Jesus says. That's opposite what they say. Don't do what they say. Do what Jesus said. So there's teaching of doctrine and at least conceptually what the philosophies of men entail. It's not teaching there in Colossians against apologetics. And in fact, you know that phrase there in Colossians 2 where it says, according to the elementary principles of the world, that is a phrase that probably is referring to a very particular kind of contrary philosophy called Gnosticism. You don't need to know all the details. You know a little bit about it, and it was became full-blown in the second century. But the point is, Paul himself is familiar with it. He's familiar with it enough to cite a concept and say, don't be taken in by this kind of thing. So when somebody says, stay away from all philosophy, that is the views that other people have of the world, and then they don't want to get particular about apologetics and sounds like even particular about doctrine, you don't know what's a lie and what isn't a lie. You can't see what the nasties are because you haven't been warned about them, and so you end up being taken in by them, which is exactly the opposite of what Paul had in mind there. So that surprises me a little bit.
I imagine you're grasping fully my frustration. I like to say I'm with a very good church now, a very loving church, and very open to community outreach. I mean, they really
that's
want
great.
To be known out in a very. I'm here in the D.C. area, very cosmopolitan area.
Right.
And they want to outreach. Now, granted, their understanding of outreach is different, I guess, from me coming in. My understanding of outreach is, hey, we got to get out there, connect with people and, you know, identify, you know, a need, want, or desire, because quite frankly, the answer is Jesus. Let's
right.
But that's not their understanding.
See,
and,
no,
quite frankly,
how could I,
in this area?
Yeah, well, this troubles me now, because I think reaching out, outreach that is helping the community in lots of different ways is really valuable. But if we are leaving out the gospel in our communication and help with other people, then we aren't doing what Jesus had in mind. Jesus said, "I came to seek and to save that which was lost. It is not the healthy that need a physician, but the sick. I came to call sinners to repentance." So if what our outreach entails does not involve that, and indeed may even shy away from it, and have our kind of good work, social gospel outreach, replace the gospel of Jesus, well, then we are not following Jesus at that point. And even no matter how wonderful and how good the things that we've been doing are, if we are doing them as a church, then the church is not fulfilling its commission. Does that make sense to you? Because the church is to guard the gospel. It's the repository.
Exactly. I passed on, you know, my question. I passed on that BLESS acronym, which they're very proud of at our church.
What does it stand for?
So it's BLESS, and so it's be prayerful, which I agree with. The L is listen. So listen more and talk less to ingratiate yourself.
Right. That's good.
Eat, break bread. This is where relationships are established. The first S is serve, you know, deference and you
right.
know, show that you care, which, I'm on board with.
Sure.
The last S ought to be share the gospel, and it's not. It's share your testimony. And I don't get that at all because, like I said, we're in D.C.
Uh-huh.
This is the Mormon capital. This is the Jehovah's Witness, everybody's
got
has
a testimony.
Right.
Well, you know, it's a nice thing to bless. It's easy to remember. Be prayerful is a good start. Of course, what end is one praying towards? Listen more, eat in relationship with each other, serve, great. But I have to agree with you. Share the gospel is a lot better than sharing testimony. Because it's not the testimony that distinguishes us from the Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses, or the New Age, or a whole host of other groups. It is the gospel that distinguishes us. So, I don't know, it took you a while to find this place, but it sounds like it's better than the place before, you know, but I don't know, maybe you want to keep your eye open for somebody, a church that is as nice as the one that you have, but also will emphasize sharing the gospel too. What do you think, Jason?
I tell you, Greg, I for the longest, and again, except for my wife, I would have continued on the, and it's not very biblical, but the Lone Ranger Christian vein, though it's not very, embers die away from the fire.
Sure, that's right. So would you say it's your wife that got you involved in any fellowship at all? Is that right?
Yeah, most definitely. I'm a hard-headed, analyst and...
and a loner. Sounds like a loner type. Well, I'm glad. Okay, well... Look at it. You're moving in the right direction here, Jason, so I commend you for that. And even if your church isn't sharing the gospel so much, but rather share your testimony as their view, you can still share the gospel and use these opportunities that you have with your church to do that, communicate the truth of the gospel. Is your wife on your side on this?
She is indeed. I mean, we're rowing in the same direction.
Yeah, well,
which
that's
very
great.
Cool.
Okay.
But I know she, she's trying to play devil's advocate because she doesn't want to leave another church. She's got friends and.
Well, I'm sympathetic to that. Okay, I get it. You want to have domestic tranquility, and sometimes you want to make the best with what you have, and you got a stable situation. So, hope that helps out, Jason, and all the best to you.
I appreciate it, Greg, and thanks again for the story of why God died. I'm going to get a bunch of those.
Okay, that sounds good. I'm glad to hear it. All righty, buddy. Bye-bye now.
Take care.
Yeah. That was great talking to him. Listen, we have to take a break, and then we'll come back to your calls on Stand to Reason.
The Apostle Paul knew well the effect on those who engaged in empty chatter as they spread the virus of false knowledge. They went astray. So while entrusting the treasure of truth to Timothy, his disciple, and encouraging Timothy to entrust it to other faithful men, Paul also exhorted him to guard the treasure in 2 Timothy 1:14. Paul's word guard comes from the activity or office of a watchman who has the job of protecting those who are asleep from harm. It implies a deliberate, conscious act and demands discernment in knowing what it is that's been placed under our care. Guard the treasure was Paul's final message to Timothy before Paul's death. It reflected the heartbeat of his ministry. It reflects the heartbeat of Stand to Reason, too. Guard the treasure which has been entrusted to you. To learn more about Stand to Reason and how we're training Christian ambassadors to guard the treasure, visit us at str.org. Our website is full of unique and useful resources to train you to be an effective ambassador for Christ. That's str.org.
Would you like to know the one unifying theme of the entire Bible? Greg Kokel reveals it to you in The Bible Fast Forward, his sweeping 8-lesson series on DVD. Greg demonstrates, from Genesis to Revelation, that the Bible represents one cohesive plan of salvation. This fascinating tour of Scripture shows you how the events, covenants, and promises of the Old Testament come to their perfect focus and fulfillment in Jesus Christ. This masterful survey of God's redemptive plan is available to you on DVD or on demand via HD streaming or download. It also includes a comprehensive 145-page study outline with questions for reflection or group discussion. To order the Bible Fast Forward, visit STR's online store at store.str.org or call 800-2-REASON today.
Show a Stand to Reason, my friends, and let me give you the number. You know, Amy just reminded me, it might be good to say the number once in a while, since we are not live broadcasting right now on radio as we used to for so many years. It didn't seem as pressing. But our number is 855-243-9975. That's 855-243-9975, and that's the number you call during our live show, which would be Tuesday evenings from 4 until 6 Los Angeles time. If you're outside of the U.S., you can dial us direct at 562-424-8229, and you'll get us as well. So looking forward to hearing from you if you'd like to chat with me about anything that's on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion. Let's see. Just a reminder that April 20th to 21st, Briarwood Presbyterian Church, Birmingham, Alabama, Rethink Bama. And we just had a fabulous time a couple of weeks ago in Dallas. And I understand we've got like 900 people already signed up. And we are more than 3 weeks away from Rethink in Alabama. And boy, I'm just thrilled to see that. My brother's actually coming. They're making a road trip with from Sarasota. And this has been characteristic every single time we've done a Rethink, that youth groups get on the road and travel and make it a big event and a big weekend. And I'm looking forward to being there with the rest of the crew, with Jay Warner Wallace and Walter Strickland and Christopher Yuan, John Stone Street. Is John Stone Street going to be in this one as well? I'm not sure. Amy Hall will be there. I'm looking at her right now, and she'll be part of it. And, of course, the rest of the Stand to Reason crowd, Tim Barnett and Alan Schliemann, myself. So it's going to be a great event. Fabulous. Drew Worsham is going to be there. Drew is kind of a new addition. He's kind of a what do you call illusionist of sort. I'm telling you, the things he does will really blow your mind. Oh, Sean McDowell. Okay, yeah. Okay, great. There you go. And but Drew Worsham is a kind of an illusionist, and it's all trickery, but I don't know how he does it. It's amazing. And when he let off, or I should say finished the Friday evening event for us in Dallas. He told the audience things are going to get a little bit weird in just a minute, and boy, did they. But it was a lot of fun. Okay, that's April 20th through 21st. Go to rethinkapologetics.com. Got it. All right. Okay, let's go to Robert somewhere in California. Where you at, Robert?
I'm in the San Jose Bay Area.
Okay.
Hi, Greg.
I was just up there last weekend and flew into Oakland, and this weekend I'll be driving into not San Jose, but what do they call it? Mount Hermon, where Mount Hermon is. That's right there on the coast. So if you go from San Jose to the coast, that's where there's a school there. What is that town? I can't think of it. Anyway, I'll be there. So Robert from San Jose area, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I have a believer friend who feels same-sex attraction, and this, you know, becomes a little bit of a problem. And our doctrine tells us that, you know, in those situations, we ought to say, hey, look, our scripture tells us it's in such. Mm-hmm. And one thing he will say, he's completely okay with it because he's not hurting anyone. And Henry's the kind of guy who doesn't want to hurt anyone. He's like one of the kindest guys on our school campus. And so, like, if I were able to present him with such a case, I really think that would hit one of his, like, hot buttons, as you say in your tactics book.
Right.
I love that book, man.
Thank you.
Great book.
Thanks.
Yeah, so how do, like, private sexual behaviors affect our culture and character? Because I know when God gives us commands, like, not to do these things, he's doing that for our protection, right?
That's right. That's a fair way of putting it. I always feel a little frustrated when confronted with challenges like this. Well, I'm not hurting anyone, because what this is called the minimalist ethic, by the way. And the idea there, it's not really relativism. It is the point of view that, yeah, there are some things that are right or wrong, but the only things that are wrong are things that hurt other people. That's called the harm principle. Okay, and as long as I'm not hurting someone else, and generally that is characterized as making them feel pain or discomfort, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And as long as I'm not doing that, or maybe bringing ill upon someone over time, as long as I'm not doing that, then how could it be considered wrong, okay? They're not violating the harm principle, and morality is captured completely by the harm principle. Okay, now
that's where a lot of folks get. I get the sentiment, oh, killing is wrong. When, like for example, we have military that kill people for reasons. It's not a murder.
Yeah, right. But they would say it's wrong because you're killing somebody. Is that what you mean? Yeah. So, well, that would violate the harm principle in their book, and so according to that standard, that's going to be wrong. Okay. The difficulty comes now. I have a couple things to say about this approach. The approach presumes that the only thing that could be wrong is if we're hurting someone else. But it seems like when you reflect on it, that there's more going on to what's right and wrong than just the harm principle. So according to this person's view, your friend's view, and I'm sure he's a very nice person. Now, I'm not taking exception with that. But does he think, and this is maybe what you can ask him a little bit, and just to help challenge this way of looking at it a little bit, does he think that, say, peeping Toms are wrong, or being a peeping Tom is doing something that's wrong? What do you think he'd say?
I have, okay, this is just a personal opinion. I think he would say no. I do not know for sure.
Huh. Well, that would be consistent with his point of view, although most people have a sense that when you are looking at someone who thinks they are in private when they're not, that the violation, there is a violation of their privacy, even though they're not being hurt, you know. So, okay, then that's not a good counterexample. The idea is to try to find illustrations where someone is not feeling pain, but it does still seem like they're being violated.
Mm-hmm.
Like somebody who's put under sedation, but then is molested. They're not feeling
put
any
under
pain.
Sedation and then reluctant?
Yeah, like if a dentist puts somebody under to work on their teeth, but then takes advantage of them in the dentist's chair.
Oh, yeah, that'd be wrong.
Well, it couldn't be wrong according to your friend's system, because you're not hurting anyone. Okay. So all these aren't going to get directly to his issue, which is private sexual behaviors with consenting adults. But it's what it's meant to do is to help the person to say that see that the system that they're using to assess is not adequate. I actually had a homosexual man call me on the radio many years ago and raise this issue, as long as I'm not hurting anyone. And I asked him, are your parents hurt because of your active homosexual behavior? And he said, yes. And I said, well, then by your standard, your behavior is hurting someone. Okay? So this brings another element in here. And the other element is we don't always have a clear fix on the consequences of our behaviors, at least not immediately. So we think, I'm not causing pain to this person I'm having a private, intimate sexual encounter with. But it may cause a baby. Not in the case of homosexuals, but in terms of heterosexual sex. And if it causes a baby, oh, man, now you've got a whole different enterprise going on. So now what? Are you want to get an abortion? Oh, that causes not just hurt to somebody, it causes their death, the baby's death.
Mm-hmm. And then for the mother as well, that kind of trauma.
Yes, and this brings another point in, which I'll get to in just a moment. But that was a good observation, though. Or if the mom carries to term, then she, you know, keeps the child. Now that she's got to care for the child, but she's not going to care for that child herself. Her mom and her dad, the baby's grandparents, are going to help care for the child and other members of the family, and they may be willing to do that, but now it's not a private affair anymore.
Right.
So part of this discussion has got to be, when you think that your behaviors are just influencing you and no one else, you may not be right. And part of the wisdom of the ages that is reflected in our social mores is that, you know, some of these people have been around the block a few times, and they know that even though it doesn't seem like we're hurting anybody now, this kind of behavior can lead to things that are really disastrous for people in the long run, which is why we say don't engage in this kind of behavior.
Right. May I ask a question?
Sure.
My goal is not to, like, you know, beat my friend to a pulp, just
right.
Try and get him on a straight path, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if there's, like, a direct case or example. I'm guessing it's a bit hard to pull, but a direct case example of, like, a cause and effect of such a misbehavior, or if those such...
Right. Well, here's one. And my goal is not that you beat your friend to a pulp at all either. What I was trying to do is lay a foundation of how to look at these things to show that this general approach is not morally sound, and really what it amounts to be, I'm just going to give you the inside scoop from my perspective, it's just self-serving. It's a way of sanitizing behavior. It's a way of saying I get to do what I want because I'm quote-unquote not hurting anybody, but of course he doesn't know that. So what if he gets AIDS? Mm-hmm. And what if he gets AIDS or any other STD and passes it to another person? Is that hurting somebody?
Yes.
Okay, how likely is it, if he's engaging in this behavior, that he can pass an STD to another person?
Pretty likely.
Yeah, pretty likely. See, you asked for let's cut to the chase kind of question or issue. Here it is. If it's pretty likely...
Yeah, that's a good example. Thank you.
If it's pretty likely that he can get an STD... And among a range of STDs, not just AIDS, and pass that STD to another person, then it's pretty likely that he's going to hurt somebody else. So by his own standard now, he is probably doing something that will result in harm. I mean, he's doing something that will probably result in harm and therefore would be immoral by his own standard. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. Here's one other thing, though, and this is, and you hinted at this a few moments ago, but I just want to make it explicit. And that is that it isn't just a matter of doing someone else harm. It is also a matter of doing us harm. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Let me say it again. It's not a matter of just doing someone else harm. It's a matter of doing us harm. If we are doing something that God says no to, and your friend calls himself a Christian, and apparently he believes, you know, something about the Bible, Christianity, God, Jesus, whatever. If he does, then God, Jesus, Christianity, the Bible, all of the above have said this behavior is not good. Same-sex behavior is not good because God did not design you that way. He designed sex for a different purpose. If you use what God designed for a different purpose than what God intended, or I should say, for a contrary purpose, that is, a way that confutes the original purpose, then you are harming not only yourself, but the person you're doing this with. You are harming their souls. Just because it feels good physically, and you can part and say, have a nice day, does not guarantee that there has been no harm that's come to either of you in the process. This is a corrupting influence. And if you want a biblical argument for this, it's 1 Corinthians chapter 6. And Paul's argument there has to do with having sex with a prostitute. So it would apply, his argument would apply the exact same way to somebody who is engaged in same-sex, because he says when you join yourself to a prostitute, you become one flesh with her, and you are essentially joining Christ to her if you're a Christian. That's harm. And like I said, the same thing applies in a same-sex kind of union. If you are joining yourself to your spouse, who is the opposite sex from you, which is God's design, that harm does not obtain. So that would be another way, I think, of talking to your friend about harm. That it's not just a harm that creates physical pain or discomfort. That's the only way he's thinking about it. But he could harm them by bringing disease to another person, and which, by the way, problem you're not going to have if you're involved in a marriage relationship.
Yeah, like monogamy.
Monogamy, yeah. You don't get the spread of STDs, characteristically, when people are monogamous. If they're chaste before marriage and then they are monogamous after marriage, you don't have to worry about this. So you can't hurt each other in that way if you are following God's plan. But if you're not following God's plan, you're doing your own thing, there's a harm. That's a physical harm, but you also have a soulish harm. You harm your souls when you engage in kinds of practice that God says no to, and you also harm your relationship with God, and you also bring judgment on yourself. 1 Corinthians chapter 6:9, that's in the same chapter as the one about the joining yourself to a prostitute. It also says if you're the kingdom of God does not belong to those people who use sex in a way that is not what God designed. Whether it's homosexual or fornication, heterosexual fornication, it says very clearly they will not inherit the kingdom of God. So one more line of thinking, and again, I don't want you to bludgeon or beat up your friend, but I think these are a couple of points that he needs to consider, especially if he considers himself a Christian. Make sense?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Robert, I got to run to a break here, all right, but that'll give you something to chew on a bit, all right?
Okay.
All righty. I appreciate the call, and let's go to break and back in just a moment.
Each of us as Christian ambassadors faces two daunting challenges when trying to make a difference for Christ. First, how do we initiate conversations about spiritual things in a way that doesn't seem awkward? Second, how do we keep ourselves from getting trapped or overwhelmed by others more aggressive than we are? Well, that's what Greg Kokel can teach you in his book and DVD curriculum on tactics. Greg will teach you how to maneuver in conversations so you can create more productive dialogue with skeptics and challengers. Tactics are practical skills that Greg gives names like Columbo, Suicide, Steamroller, Rhodes Scholar, and more. Tactics are a way of engaging others effectively and winsomely, no matter what the subject. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, then Tactics is for you. Order Tactics in book, DVD, CD, or MP3 format at STR's online store at str.org. Or simply give us a call at 800-2-REASON. That's Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions.
You know, since 1990, I have taken all kinds of questions and challenges from callers from all over the world, and I would like to hear from you, too. Now, you may have a question or a challenge on ethics, values, or religion that you want to discuss with me live in the show, but I know it can be hard to find time in your schedule to call and wait online. So we've come up with a convenient solution. Here it is. Click the banner at str.org that says, Question for Greg, Ask Now. And fill out the form on the website, and if your question is chosen, we'll give you a call between 4 and 6 p.m. Pacific time on Tuesday during the live show, and we'll make sure you get a chance to talk with me. We'll make an appointment with you in advance. Click the banner on the homepage or visit str.org/training/broadcast and simply fill out the online form today, and then we'll talk. Final segment here on this hour, and let's go to Daniel from Des Moines. I love the alliteration there, Dan. Daniel.
Thanks,
from
Greg.
Des Moines. It sounds really good. How can I help you?
So I'm going to be teaching an apologetics course at my church.
Good for you.
Thanks. We've been studying apologetics kind of casually for about 5 years, listening to your show, reading some William Lane Craig stuff, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was planning to start the first half of the course with Tactics, the DVD series.
Well, I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, you know.
If I do say so myself.
Yeah. And then for the second half, I was going to just go over some of the arguments for and against Christianity that you might run into out there.
Right.
So my question was, which arguments, like, do you run into against Christianity most often?
Mm-hmm.
And which ones do you find to be most useful in favor of Christianity?
Yeah, I'm glad the way you asked the question, because as I was anticipating your question, I was just jotting down that the best arguments that you teach to Christians are going to be the arguments that either, one, address the questions being asked, and that would be the challenges from the outside, or, two, address the doubts being felt by the Christians. Now, those may be two different things. That is, there are different kinds of things that come in at different times from the skeptics or the people pushing back. And last hour, I had Todd Wilson on, and his book is Mere Sexuality. And he talked with me about, pointed out something I already knew, that there are lots of people now that are pushing back on Christianity, not because it's false. That isn't their concern, but that it's mean or it's immoral because it interferes with people's sexual expression, which they equate with human flourishing. So, so that means that, okay, if we're getting pushback there, then how do we deal with that? I actually think that kind of pushback is a really tough one to deal with, because because it's complex and it's a fairly new one. So it isn't like we've worked out these good ways to get back at that. I know Craig Hazen has raised a question once in a group setting where there were a lot of non-Christians that were pushing back. There actually was a group of homosexuals, as I recall. And he said, let's just say, what if there was a God? What if there was a God? Do you think that he would have something legitimate to say about our sexual behavior? That was the way he put the question. What if there was? Maybe there isn't. But if there was a God, would it be legitimate for him to weigh in on this? Would we have any responsibility? And what he says, and his, as he offers this anecdote, is that the people that got them thinking, they said, well, yeah, if there really was a God, then he might have something to say about it in light of the fact that God made us a certain way. And I guess the tough spot, the in general, the thing to show in that circumstance is that God has a design for human flourishing, but it isn't what they're pursuing. The problem is between you and I think that's a tough one to kind of teach others to respond to. And so I would lay that one aside for the moment, maybe recommend Todd Wilson's book, Mere Sexuality, or Nancy Pearce's Love Thy Body, to kind of cover that ground. But go to some other issues that are a little bit more accessible and that our team of Christians has worked through a little better. And a big one is the science one. That is, that science has somehow disproved God, and you don't need God because you got science. It's a good little book by John Lennox called, I think it's called God's Grave Digger or something to that effect. Is that it, Amy? Did John Lennox write something like God's Grave Digger? She's looking it up right now. But that asks the question whether science has buried God or not, but that would be a resource. It's not a very long book, I don't think. Oh, she's given it to me. Hold on. It's not by Lennox. It's God's. I think Lennox did a book on the Lennox. But anyway, that's one issue. So science, I think, would be a big issue. The problem of evil is a perennial. And that's right. One that's not only one that non-Christians push back with, but it's. Oh, God's Undertaker. Okay. The one by Lennox is God's Undertaker. So I was close. I was in the ballpark. But the problem of evil is also one that that strands believers in their own convictions. So this hits both categories, the skeptics and the Christian, and they wonder, gee, this happened to me. How can there be a God? So I think the right. problem of evil is a big one. I think the problem of religious pluralism, why Jesus is the only way of salvation, that just seems that Christianity is suffocatingly narrow to people, I think, is a problem. The now I have said, and I try to develop this in the story of reality in an accessible way, that sometimes singular problems like the problem of evil have singular solutions, which would be Jesus. So I see the problem of evil as not being a problem for Christians the way other people think it is, and that Jesus is the only way is tied into the solution of that. But those are things that people push back on. One thing you might think about doing is, I don't know how big your class is, and I do think that starting with taxics is the absolute best way to start, and I'm not saying that because I wrote the book. if somebody else's name were on it, I would say that because I think it's going to do the best thing to equip your people regardless of what they know, because there's an educational component to using the tactics. You're asking, what do you know? What do you mean by that? And how'd you come to that conclusion? That's how we can get an education on other people's views. So I think that's great. But I think that if you have a group of people that's in situ, that as you're teaching tactics, you know who your classmates or your students are going to be. Ask them, do a little a poll. What are the things that you're running up against? And then see what they have to say. And then maybe that would be something that can inform your curriculum after that.
Yeah, I was planning on doing that as kind of an icebreaker here this Sunday. But I also wanted to have that sort of base of these are the ones that we're definitely going to cover either way.
Uh-huh.
You know, and then what some other things that you've run up against, you know, kind of because the objections are always. No, there's just an infinite number of different objections.
It seems that way sometimes, doesn't it? It turns out that it's finite, and there's probably a handful of them, five or six, that come up on a regular basis. The problem of evil is one of them. Religious pluralism, why Jesus is the only way is another big one. The science issue is a big one. Now the sexual issues, the gender things, all of that. Answering that requires our ability to understand God's reason or God's purpose for human flourishing in sex. And this is where Todd Wilson's Mere Sexuality, I think, comes into play. It's not very long. It's just 160 pages or so that fairly easy read, and he's pretty clear about some things. But the task of trying to show people that God's way is the way that leads to flourishing is sometimes difficult. Maybe the best way to show that God's way is to address that point is to show that their way does not lead to flourishing.
Right.
And when you look at the dissatisfactions that people are experiencing with the sexual revolution, we look at the STD crisis in many places, we see the depression that women experience through friends with privileges and all of that. That might be the best way to approach that. But there's a couple of suggestions for you, Daniel, in Des Moines, and maybe it'll get you going, okay?
All righty.
Okay.
Thanks, Greg.
I suggest you talk to your classmates, though, after you start into the tactics, and then just ask them, what are you running into, or what would you like to have answered? Remember, it's not just what the skeptics are asking. It's the doubts that the Christians are feeling that your apologetics are going to help to deal with, to help assuage, to help answer, so that they're stronger and more confident themselves.
Okay. All right.
All righty?
All righty.
Hey, thanks for the call.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye. Well, that's it. Two things. Sometimes apologetics is for the other guy. Sometimes it's for us. And I think, frankly, that apologetics, one of the greatest advantages to that is it's going to answer the greatest critic that we will ever face in our lives, and that is ourselves. When you wake up in the middle of the night and you wonder, gee, am I wishing on a star here, barking up the wrong tree or whatever? For me, that happens, and it's my understanding of the reasons, my apologetics, that gets me back to sleep. Thanks for being part of the show. I'm Greg Kokel. Give them heaven this week. Bye-bye now.